This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You're listening to iFanboy Talksplode with writer Rick Remender of Uncanny X-Force, Venom, and Fear Agent. Welcome to another edition of iFanboy Talksplode. My name is Ron Richards, and for those of you who follow iFanboy know that I've been raving and loving Uncanny X-Force for the past year, and now that the Dark Angel saga has wrapped up and the first 18 issues major story arc of Uncanny X-Force is complete, thought it'd be a good time to catch up with writer Rick Remender and chat about X-Force, as well as Venom, Fear Agent, and his other projects. We'll always have fun talking to Rick, and I hope you enjoy it.
I'm here with writer Rick Remender. How's it going, Rick?
It's going terrifically. Fantastic.
Excellent,
I'm great.
Excellent.
So happy. So good.
So you are no stranger to the iFanboy podcast, and we thought it was another good time to check in as Uncanny X-Force number 18 just came out this week, and Dark Angel Saga is concluded, and it's a big kind of marker in your run on X-Force, right?
Yeah, it ends the first year of stories, basically.
Yeah, so first off, I mean, I'm sure you see me gushing on the internet and talking about it, but I believe that it is the best ongoing at Marvel right now.
I do too.
Nice, good. Yeah, you should as well. But what I think
you're right, Ron. I think more people should probably recognize that.
Yeah. Well, what I think is the most amazing about it is that so the book launched, what was it, September or October of 2010 last year? It was.
I don't know. Can I rewind it? That I was being facetious before. Like that. There's people who don't know us and don't know what we do when we talk to each other, and they're going to hear me and go, "What a fucking asshole that guy is." I'm really more self-effacing. Anyway.
You are. No, but
this is going south. I'd like to end this.
No, but anyway, so one of the things I think is amazing is that in a year of doing the book, you put out it's one of those titles that Marvel double shipped a lot, and yeah. I don't think anyone ever complained about the double shipping.
Some people did, but you know that's what Twitter is there for, is to give people a window to throw things at me occasionally. Like, why are you doing this? I'm like, I'm just working. That's the great thing about Twitter. Twitter's literally like just a million opportunities for people to throw things at me. But no, for the most part, I think that the double shipping, as long as there's a plan in place and it's well in advance, and you can tell that the writer's not scrambling. We had a big story. We knew a year and a half, 2 years ago when I first took the book that we were going to have to, you know, put out 18, 19 issues a year. We knew that that was what we were going to do going in. And so, Axel and Jody and I, when we first started the thing up, put together a plan that got us to the end point at 18, 19 issues. Now, of course, as we were moving, it shifted and developed a little bit, but you know, it's all sort of seated there in the first issue, and it goes forward. And I think as long as the story is fluid, People are okay with the double shift, but you know, we also benefited from the fact that Esad stuck around to do covers, you know. That never happens. Guys like Esad do a run and they go off to the next thing, you know. But Esad stuck it out and he did the full year's worth of covers. And Dean White, you know, stuck around to add consistency. The only arc he didn't do was the one Matt Wilson did over Esad. But so, you know.
Yeah, and so now you're standing on an 18 issue complete story arc. I mean, we talked about it. You said that you were planning, and you just said that you guys were planning this whole thing. But from issue one, this was your endpoint, right? I mean, am I reading that correctly? Or
yeah. I mean, that was it was something that obviously at the very beginning, I don't think that there was a super definitive like how it was going to end, but it was something that I wanted to explore. What was Archangel? And then after I started to build on that, you know, Jody had a ton of ideas, and we started working together on defining the Apocalypse mythology and expanding on it. And, you know, then I wanted to, and as that happened, it just made sense to go to the, you know, we need something that deals with Apocalypse, X, Y, and Z, some you know, MacGuffin-y relic. Why not go to the Age of Apocalypse, you know, and think about Wolverine finding out. And, you know, stumbling into a dimension where he can see the daughter he never had with Mariko, and he can see Jean still alive and Kurt still alive, and Sabretooth is a good guy, and that seemed like a fun, meaty story, for, you know, and everything just kind of built out of that one idea that Archangel is starting to take over Warren finally, this thing that was began with the Simonsons back in
Factor 20 something, right? Yeah, like way back in the day.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. Well, yeah, well, definitely. I mean, like, I've been on the edge of my seat for every issue. I mean, it's been the first book I read every week just to see the layering of, you know, how the story developed and even the way it integrated with, like, recently what happened with, you know, Wolverine and the X-Men over Jason Aaron with, like, the Iceman stuff. Like, the fact that, you know, Wolverine's fighting Iceman and commenting about his powers, and then over in Wolverine and the X-Men, Jason picked up on that and had the same thing happen almost. Like, that, it's been a good time for the X-Men book, so I'm a little fan. I'm freaking out as a fan a little bit, so bear with me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I am too, and we all are. And that's why, you know, when Jason and Kieran and I were at our first retreat all at the same time, God, it was 2 years ago. It's so wild because you plan things 2 years ago and they're just now coming to an end. But it was something where, because we all knew each other, we wanted to be mindful that if we had an opportunity to try and interconnect our stories and build off of what one another were doing, and that's not to say that we're excluding other people because we're not friends with them. Like, oh, you know. I don't know that guy writing New Mutants, so I won't tie into that. It was just that because we actually do communicate and we are friends, that it would be easy to try and find ways to interconnect. And so everybody at this retreat, as we were cooking up our stories, we all ended up finding little bits of interconnectivity. You're going to see a lot of it coming up here in the next 2 months. The one thing that was important was that the events of the Dark Angel saga, because they're so big, but they were underground, that when that oil starts bubbling to the top, that it then start to affect the other X-books a little bit. And we see that with Uncanny X-Men as we deal with Psylocke and her return to Tabula Rasa, that city in Montana that Warren used Genesis to nuke, and then regrew an entire new area there, and that's, you're going to see a lot of that coming up. There's a lot of big plans for Tabula Rasa. There's basically a new, it's like, you know, alien landscape in the middle of Montana there. And then there will be a lot of different threads. Jason Aaron and I are in constant contact and have tried to tie these things very, very well together. So there's a lot of stuff that will then, after you read X-Force 19, you go and you read Wolverine and the X-Men 4 and 5, and you get a whole... You get the rest of the story, kind of picks up there.
That's got to be really rough for you to work with Jason Aaron. I mean, I heard he's really difficult.
Well, yeah, Jason is. Well, he's not a real. He's not a real American, for one. He's part of the. He's from the South,
right?
So, you know, you can't trust him, and he's always drunk on moonshine. And I'm always telling him to make sure to clean the still so he doesn't get mercury poisoning. But he doesn't care, and he gets really surly.
He comes off really nice at the cons, but it's a whole different thing. It's
yeah. I told you the three-figure deal.
You did tell me the three-figure deal. If you want to retell it, go right ahead.
I'll save it. I don't know.
Oh, for those
are we? I'll give the short version. So one evening over a few drinks with Jason and I think it was Lee Lowridge and I were talking about I don't know, Hollywood movie money that comes in every once in a while or something along those lines. And Jason had a few drinks and he was like, oh yeah, well, you know, that I hear those guys are, you know, that guy got paid a 3-figure deal for that. And everybody kind of, Lee and I looked at each other and paused the beat and looked at him, and we realized that he had just, that Jason had just gotten really excited over somebody being paid somewhere between $1 and $999 for selling a property to Hollywood, at which point the next 7 hours were spent figuring out new ways to insult Jason based on his three-figure deal, you know. I got he come talk to Jason Aaron, first things first. 3 figures. No, I ain't talking to you less than that. Now, they come at me with a 2-figure deal, and I said, not Jason. Jason Aaron's a 3-figure deal, man. What you putting on the plate there? If it ain't 3 figures, don't talk to Jason Aaron. And then he drank out of his hose and molested his next of kin. I think that's on and on and on.
Oh, God, that's too funny. But yeah, so anyway, back to the comics. I was going to ask you whether or not, like, we were going to see, and maybe it was a question more for Jason, but whether or not, you know, because pretty much the basis of X-Force, as you said, was there was the secret black op teams nobody knows about. And you stuck to it over this past year. It didn't seep into any of the other books, but, like, you know, big shit happened in this. It's got to have an effect.
It seemed, you know, like you don't want to, the weight of a story shouldn't come from its effect on other books or continuity. But what it naturally does, when it has natural consequences, you know, like, there are things in there that will be no-brainers. When people read issue 19, it'll just be common sense. Yes, this makes sense. There are things that my book and its mandate fit, and some things that it just doesn't fit. And so when they have an event like what we've had for these last 18 issues and what's left, you know, especially given what happens with Warren and Evan and the world and all of this stuff, it's going to have an effect on the rest of the characters. And I liked that it came about naturally in conversations where I told those guys, like, you know, you connect to my book. It was like really natural the way I barked it at them post-coital.
Yeah. So now looking back on the 18 issues, you know, did everything go as you envisioned it? Were there anything that you would do differently? Or, like, looking back on this kind of like this run, I mean, are you happy with it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, it's always this weird... There's always something very strange about your own personal reaction to something that you've worked on versus fans' reaction, and when readers when people who, you know, who read something, they get something very different out of it, and it's always a very interesting thing to see. And I do end up, you know, scouring the internet at 3 a.m. every couple few days and out of boredom. And I was wondering one night, I'm like, why am I doing this? Do I need validation? You know, like, am I this insecure? And I was like, I'm really not. I kind of am pretty happy with what I do, and I just do what I like. But I still go scouring the internet for this stuff, and I realize it was because there's so many different interpretations people take from these things, and people read so much into it, you know, and that's the fun of writing, is to try and hopefully you have your intention, and you can execute your intention in a way where people absorb it and they really respond to it. But it's a lot of other stuff. So in terms of the arc so far, there's been issues that I thought were just flat, boring, you know, like things that I felt like I had failed and that everybody went apeshit over.
Yeah, like what?
And
I'm going to call you out on it.
I felt like that Shadow King issue was a real turkey. And I felt like that. And then there was one issue that I felt like the Shadow King thing I felt was three issues that I over condensed into one issue. And people like that, you know, like I like condensed storytelling, but there's also a point where, you know, it can't be so condensed that it just feels like information being shot at you. And the, My fear when I was finished with that issue was that what I had accomplished was to take what was, you know, should I think it was two issues when I initially broke it down, and then it ended up just taking place in like one 22-page issue. It did feel a little bit too, it felt very fast. It came out and it was one of the more popular, whereas the thing I did with Raphael Albuquerque in 5.1, which seeds the Descendants and all the stuff I've got, coming up in X-Force and Secret Avengers, this year. I was super crazy proud of that. And I thought it was like Albuquerque and Dean White, just like science on the art. And I it was Lady Deathstrike and the Reavers back in action. And there was like a mixed, very mixed reaction to that issue. So it's always interesting how your enthusiasm and your love for something and like where you're coming from can be interpreted. And it's very infrequent that you feel super confident about something. And it's something that is also, that you see that same reaction from the people who read it.
Yeah. No, it's. I mean, it's. I'm always fascinated by that, but by, you know, kind of because you get so close to it, and then there's no way to know what our reaction is going to be and what's going to trigger with. Like, what triggered with me as a fan is probably much different than what triggered. Well, I know, for example, even at iFanboy, like I'm a big X-Men fan. I geeked out. Like we talked, like in the early issues when at Warren's base where he had the paintings of the X teams. Like I thought that was great. And meanwhile, like Connor and Josh didn't care about that, but they thought the Opeña's art was great. Like it affected different people in different ways.
Yeah, and it always will. And so for me, I think it's one of the really fascinating components to this job is to see different people react different ways. And it's a treat, you know, what a great job you get to tell stories and watch people react in different ways to them, be it positive or negative. I'm past where it even really affects me emotionally. Right. Either way, it's nice if they like it, but it's almost, if I read, you know, solid criticism or if somebody didn't like it, it's almost the same sort of emotional payout.
Yeah, totally. All right, so now, you know, we're at issue 18, so what's to come? I mean, are you done, or do you got more X-Force stories in you, or?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I've got...
I asked that question knowing that I just put up a preview of issue 19, so I know that there's more, but still.
That segue sucked, okay. No, good. It's a good job you picked. You're good at this. You're good at the job, Ron. Yeah, there are more issues, as you just pointed out, that you have run a preview of one of them. It's what's crazy is that I find getting out of the train, getting out of the station, getting the train out of the station on a new story is always the hardest part. And taking on a new book, you know, like my wife pointed out that when I took Venom, I lost 6 weeks of work because I was just, you know, writing notes and doing my beautiful mind crazy thing where I'm, you know, notepads all over the wall and, you know, streaming jets of jism everywhere. I mean, wacky string. That's how I connect story.
String, you have Kansas.
I use silly string. And I go, there! So once you get the train going out of the station, and things are moving, ideas just start falling, and that's when I really start having fun. So this opening arc, this Apocalypse Solution, has just given birth to so many other ideas that it's just, I love kind of building more off of the same mega arc. You know, like you look at what we did in Dark Angel Saga. That's kind of, it's the end of some stuff, but god damn, I mean, there's so much more to be done with that still, and. I wrote a note when I wrote issue 5, where Betsy goes and has a danger room sequence with her brother Brian, who is Captain Britain to people who aren't nerds, and probably aren't listening to this if they're not. I don't think an investment banker stumbled onto your podcast and was like, "What's all this about X-Force?"
You'd be surprised. I've gotten feedback from people who do not read or know anything about comics yet listen to our podcasts.
That's wild.
Isn't that crazy?
That's a weird thing. Yeah. Well, if you're one of those people and you're listening right now, you're a weirdo. You're a weird weirdo. That's a weird, weird thing to choose to do. Just to listen, because you can imagine what kind of nonsense it sounds like we're talking about. You know, like we sound like we're doing when people make fun of nerds. You know, like, well, first of all, Captain Britain showed up in 17 time of year, and we take it all super serious, you know? Issue 17 and Pathos were very well established there. Like, it's definitely what we sound like.
Yeah. Well, I'm not quite sure whether those people are laughing with us or at us. So that's still
maybe a little both. This could be a pretty good bit of comedy if you were a normal.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I call people who are uninitiated into our little nerd attic. But Betsy was hanging out with her brother, Brian Braddock, the Captain Britain. and it was the scene where Betsy had created a hologram of her brother so he could absolve her of her sins and forgive her and love her and tell her what she wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And the intention was always that Betsy created this because she needed it. She needed the acceptance, and I wanted to start getting people used to her, who her family, members are. But I wrote a note down, but Brian would absolutely be would not forgive her for this.
Right.
This is absolutely not what Brian would do. And that gave birth to, man, you know what I like? I like fantasy. I like giant dragons, and I like Captain Britain Korsmans coming from other, dimensions, riding in on mummy horses and giant floating castles and troll warlords, and man, I've gone Dungeons and Dragons crazy on this shit. So I picked up that thread of the Captain Britain thing in Otherworld, and then it fell into another story where Phantom X, as I'm building his origin, has connective tissue to the Braddocks, and I've been working really hard with current editor Nick Lowe to make sure this stuff all lines up. We're not going to reveal everything, but we'll be touching on who Phantom X is and his origin and his arch nemesis, the Skinless Man, and a few other things here as we progress. And that all tied into Otherworld. He has these sentient bullets that Phantom X uses were a gift from James Braddock, which is Elizabeth's father. And there's all of this interconnectivity that I then built the first part of the second year of stories on, and that's the Otherworld chapter that's coming up. And I got my Last Days of American Crime artist, Greg Tocchini, to come in and draw that. He's been doing a great job. So it's been the story doesn't slow down. What happens at the end of 18 is really just, it's a punctuation. And then 19, we catch our breath for a second. And then by the end of 19, the other world story is off and running. And then that leads into to four other stories that will then culminate in something very similar to the Dark Angel saga in terms of scope. I think probably around issue 32 or 33.
Cool. So that's one thing I wanted to touch upon as well too quickly, is with Phantom X. I mean, that's really been the dark horse sleeper hit of the series, is that you've kind of reintroduced Phantom X to a whole new audience, and now people fucking love that character now. Whereas previously it was just that weird dude that Morrison introduced. Again, was that one of those happy accidents, or did you know that I'm going to make Phantom X a player?
Well, Jason Aaron and Fraction were the guys who went to that to try and really get him back on the board. And I think it was Jason's the list Wolverine, where he reintroduced the world and Phantom X, and established that the world was being shrunk down to the size of a snow globe and kept in Phantom X's pocket by a shrink ray gun that Phantom X acquired from Doctor Doom. So Jason seeded that there, and then when Phantom X was available and assigned to the X-Force squadron, and I started to put together the pieces, I realized what Jason had done was to set up something that gave me a million ideas. And Jason and I had at that point been talking about Deathlok quite a bit, and I had some ideas for something that was going to that I didn't know quite what to do with these Deathlok ideas. We had cooked something up before he did his Deathlok story in Weapon X, that would be a part two to that I would tell. And then I realized that it fit very well in this story, as did Deathlok, as did the world. So a lot of these pieces are things that Jason had put on the board, and I picked them up and ran with them and built them up a little bit. So in terms of Phantom X, I don't think I would have had the instinct to choose him. I definitely don't think I would have, you know, that's the great thing about something where, you know, at the end of an issue, Jason says, oh, and the world has shrunk down and it's in Phantom X's pocket. And then I inherited Phantom X and I was like, I called Jason and I'm like, so this, has this been changed? Has he shrunk down the world and he keeps it in his pocket? And Jason's like, yep. And I'm like, and nobody's done anything with this. And he's like, nope. And I was like, all right, fuckers. That was a big tip of the hat to Jason on that one, because that was a really great setup to get to play with. And as for the character and his voice and what I do with him, I reread all of Grant's stuff twice. I made a ton of notes about what I thought the character was about. I have a slightly different interpretation of how the misdirection works, but for the most part, I was very like in issue 19, we see him drink a beer by pouring it on his head, or cooling his brains down or whatever Grant was thinking when he had him do that. I want to be, you know, like, it's Grant's character. I want to make sure that I'm respectful and reverent of what he had done there without being slavishly tethered to that. And hopefully what's built up out of that is something that people enjoy.
Yeah. So cool. So the last thing on Uncanny X-Force before I want to ask you about your other stuff, but the 18 that just came out, issue 18, the whole end of Angel and with Betty, Betsy. I tweeted it. I don't know if you saw it, but I never thought I'd get choked up during an X-Force comic. and that's the thing about this comic, is that it's been surprising and unexpected at every turn. And the fact that you went so emotional with that, like, that was some hardcore shit, man. That was like, it was a big fight, but then it got all sad. Like, that was.
Well, it's all context.
Yeah,
you
know, I know. But
that all these books, you know, we all get, and I, to be fair, I rewrote those last two issues three times. And I mean, when I say rewrote, I mean, final script had been done, and Jody and I would get on the horn and come up with better ideas and rework it. And I rewrote those from ground three times each. And each time the question was, can I get away with fewer scenes of Wild Child swiping at Archangel and add in something that actually makes me care about these characters? And that thought led to the solution to Betsy's death persona being a flashback to the first time that Betsy and Warren met, in the prior issue where we see the Hellfire Club sequence. And that instinct leads to a lot of things where you're writing these action sequences and they're so easy to get lost into. He jumps here, flips over there, kicks this, you know, the ground crashes in, wide angle as they fall into the next level. And I start storyboarding in my head and I'll forget, well, why do I care about this fight? What are the stakes? And that instinct will always force me to sort of step back and go, all right, your real responsibility here is human emotion and to make me care about these people. And not just because I've seen them in a comic book a million times, you know, like, no, not the guy who was in the other comic books. Don't kill him. But in terms of actually make me give two shits and every single time I read the book. So it's a trick. And it can be hard to do to establish the, you know, any kind of pathos and to make anybody really care about these characters again. But that was the goal here anyway, was to make sure that what we had at the ending was more than just that it was satisfying and heartfelt. And it really was very important to me to answer the question, was Phantom X right? Was Betsy only with Warren because she was trying to, save him from himself, or she felt obligated and felt a sense of responsibility. And the answer is, while that might've been a component to their relationship, which was complex, these two loved each other. And had they been normal people in normal circumstances, they could have lived their lives together and enjoyed normalcy. And I felt like it was kind of a cool thing. If you're going to kill one of the original five X-Men, to give them that closure and to give them that satisfaction of seeing this is the life these guys really deserve to have. And to see Warren clean of all of this stuff, reflecting on just how far the X-Men have come from where they should be and what Xavier originally intended.
Yeah, I mean, it carried all that emotional weight. Like, throughout the whole series, you kind of got that sense, but then that whole sequence of them seeing their life go through, and it was great. And then I got to give you a great last page with the explosion in the background, the snow, and like it was cinematic.
That's easy to write. It's easy to write, you know, she runs to Warren and kisses him.
Yeah.
Warren pushes her away, looks at her confused, pull back wide, and she says, "Who are you?" I don't even know if I wrote having the world blowing up in the background. I think that's because Jerome Pena is a fucking genius.
Yeah, insane.
And really, as much fun as it is to sit here and talk about it, like, it's so much of it is Jerome. I mean, the storytelling, I can cut dialogue out and the emotion that's conveyed. So much of it is because this guy knows how to, he knows how to stage a scene. He knows how to tell story. He knows how to convey real human emotion on faces and subtlety. Like, everybody thinks they need to sell you every single thing with an exclamation mark and everything. And Jerome's is, you'll catch a face and it'll give you the information you need. And a lot of the times it'll be very subtle information.
Yeah.
And he cares about conveying the story. Like, there's a scene in there that nobody picked up on that Jerome, you know, Dark Beast has this backpack that has a dimensional gateway to his laboratory where he can just call out whatever he needs. We've seen him pop a rocket pack out and all these different things. And there's a scene where he has to rocket pack away with War in one hand and Pestilence in the other. Jerome has him grow a cable robot arm before he lifts War up. And if you look at the shot where he's rocketing towards you, if you look at his arm,
yeah,
he's got this super cyborg arm where he's holding War.
Yeah.
And it's in the corner, crammed into a wide-angle horizontal panel. And but he cares so much that the suspension of belief that every bit of the story is conveyed, and there's no like, well, Dark Beast can't carry War. And I like that he cares about that stuff that much. You know, I like it because there's no jump between panels where I go, oh, well, I guess they're just not going to deal with that. It's all very responsibly dealt with. So it's a treat. I mean, yeah, I think that was Jerome. The way he staged that, showing the world blowing up in the background, that was a Jerome call. And of course then Dean comes in and just makes it into this, just this spectacular image. And it makes me look really good.
It looks great. It looks amazing. So, so congratulations. Great job. And I can't wait for more on Uncanny X-Force. But, one of the big announcements at New York Comic Con was Secret Avengers, you and Gabe Hardman taking over Secret Avengers. And I thought it was interesting that you've been doing the kind of the Secret X-Men team. And now you're taking the Secret Avengers team, you know, like that's a little bit of a thread.
And the Secret Spider-Man guy.
Yeah, exactly. With Venom. Yeah. What's with the why do you like secrets, Rick? Why are you so secretive?
That's just Marvel's vision for me. keep that guy in his own corner, away from the rest of us.
So a couple of questions about Secret Avengers, though. One of the big surprises was we saw that team, that great Gabe Hardman team shot, and Captain Britain is in it. And so, is there some Braddock? Like, are you just obsessed with the Braddocks, or why are you?
I really dug the shit out of them as a kid, but they were never like my most favorite thing. And you know, I remember when Excalibur launched, I went back and found a lot of the Marvel UK stuff to read up on him and what had gone on, especially given how much of the continuity was picked up from what Alan Davis and Alan Moore and Claremont had done. And I liked it, but I liked all that stuff. You know, it was never a particular favorite of mine. But again, the scene that I wrote where Betsy was pretending to talk to her brother after having been involved in the killing of Kid Apocalypse, it started notes, and I started writing notes. And then again in issue 8, you know, you're in Betsy's subconscious, and I needed two halves of her conscious to be arguing. And what better than Jamie, her former Playboy brother who became, you know, this just nut job who can twist reality. He can pull at the strings of reality and change causality to fit his every whim. And her brother Brian has been forced to basically become Captain, Omniverse, protector of everything, as well as, you know, head of MI-13 and Excalibur and all these other things. And then you get to Otherworld, which has this rich history in Marvel Comics, and it's this great fantasy land, and it's basically, you know, the way Thor and these things play off Norse mythology. This is playing off of Celtic, and it's got like Merlin, and it's got Arthurian Camelot stuff, and it's very similar. It's you know it in terms of taking old mythology and introducing it in the Marvel Universe. And it was something that Stan Lee and Kirby introduced, I think, in like FF59 or I don't know, something, when they first went there, and it was called Avalon. So it's got this old, it's got this rich history. It's a Stan and Jack thing. It's a wonderful Dungeons and Dragons dimension that is also the dimension between all other dimensions, right. The origin of magic, and there's a tower. There's the Tower Otherworld within the Starlight Citadel that has a door that leads to every other dimension. And I'm just like, well, fuck. Nobody's grabbed for this toy. Like. You guys can have Iron Man. Fuck that shit. This is amazing. Like, this is where I gotta go. Yeah. And so, in terms of, like, for me, like, the fun about the Marvel Universe is not the toys that everybody's trying to grab at and that you see in seven different books, because it becomes, you know, diluted, for sure. But it's the things like this. It's the things that have had so many different great minds help build on it. In this case of Avalon and Otherworld, Stan Lee, Chris Claremont, Alan Moore, Alan Davis. I mean, that's some rich history. Why isn't this place being you know, explored more often? So that's where it comes from for me. And then I get into all of the, you know, Roma and Merlin and the stuff that they were dealing with the X-Men forever. And this is
real deep Claremont shit that you're getting into.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely. But beyond that, beyond all of that stuff, I can define this in a way that a new reader is just going like, this is a really, really awesome new place to go have adventures and look around. Yeah. And when you got a guy like Greg Tokini drawing it, You better be doing some double page spreads of three-headed dragons chasing your team, and given that we're, you know, going back there, you better bring back Widget and put Megan in the mix.
Oh man, really?
A sort of fake little Excalibur reunion of sorts. I got some moments in here that fans of old X-Men fans will scream and squeal about in excitement. I think I did when I came up with it.
You're not bringing back TechNet.
I would love to. There's no time. There's so many of those. But were there interest? I would. Yeah. I think Otherworld, beyond all of the different fringe things that were created in that run, I think Otherworld is a stage and is a place. Long story short, and I'm sorry for babbling here.
No,
but as
great.
I was building this stuff, especially with the Tower of Otherworld within the Starlight Citadel, I began to get fixated on this, on how much potential there was. And so when I was assigned to Secret Avengers, Captain, one of the mandates of the team, because as interesting as International is, I want more. And if this is going to be the clandestine squad of the Avengers who are often secret doing secret things, I want them to be dealing with international and interdimensional and supernatural threats, all manner of threats that are bubbling underneath the surface. And so Captain Britain was a natural choice, given that he has access to every single doorway to every single what-if dimension ever created. And that's something that, you know, I'm definitely building an arc off of, at least.
So that was kind of my question, was that, you know, with Captain Britain and the Avengers, it was kind of, everyone kind of went, huh? Because for some reason, everyone thinks Avengers are just American, even though right. Black Panther and, you know, there have been right. international presences on the Avengers team. But then, so everyone has got this, you know, American-centric view, which I'm not surprised by. But then also, you know, given what his back history was, and he's never really – Captain Britain's one of those guys who's never really come over to the Avengers. I mean, there was Excalibur and the X-Men, and then there was the Marvel team-up days when he was Spidey's roommate. Do you remember that? But beyond that, he never really interacts with the rest of the Marvel Universe. So it's like, I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, me too. And he's such a great character. And I think that the thing, you know, he's a physicist who was forced to accept magic in order to be, you know, to be saved after a terrible accident. And I'm trying to redefine. I'm trying to take bits and pieces from all of these different incarnations, because every time a new writer takes him on, there's always new rules to his powers. And so I've developed this thing where that is because Merlin is testing him all the time. And as soon as he overcomes one batch of personal insecurities or failings, then the power set changes to test him again. And when I came up with that, that's the kind of stuff that we did with Archangel. You know, was like, there's obviously going to be holes in continuity because five different writers handled it over 5 years. I want to also try and clean that up, and that's just a weird nerd instinct that I have. But So one of the things that we did was to, you know, to clean up that mythology and to clean up how his powers work. And we really focus on that more in Secret Avengers than we do in X-Force. X-Force, he plays a big role, but that's obviously, he's not the focus of the story. And so I wanted to save the Brian building stuff for the Secret Avengers.
So is it, do you advise somebody who's into Secret Avengers and going to read it? Should they be reading this X-Force arc that's coming up?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you gotta. Yeah. I honestly think you gotta catch up on X-Force, Venom, and start my Secret Avengers, because I'm interconnected.
Well, because Venom's in Secret Avengers as well too. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It flashes, and that's gonna play a big role. I mean, you know, there's gonna be a lot of stuff that comes out of that. So, I don't know. I mean, again, with the interconnecting of the dots, when I'm writing one thing that has a natural connection to another, as long as it's not forced, as long as it comes about naturally as I'm writing, I go, oh, you know, well, okay, you know, Brian and Betsy haven't had it out yet, and this and that, and no, well, what happens if this happens, and what if this and that, and Betsy and Brian have a psychic connection, and they can see what the other person's up to, and all of a sudden, I've got a brother and sister on each, on the Avengers, you know, covert squad, and on the X-Men hit squad. And that leads to all kinds of fun interconnecting things. One of the big things is the Descendants, which this automaton species that are.
Are they all named Milo? Or
what's that?
Are they all named Milo?
They're all named Milo. Every one of them. None of them want to grow up.
Sorry.
This is something that I've been working on since before the first issue of X-Force even came out, and it was a big idea I had about the evolution of the Marvel robots. You know, we're always fixated on the evolution of the humans and the mutants and the, you know, Jim Jams, and I'm like, you know what? What about the robots? Because this is, you know, Ray Kurzweil with Singularity and all these really interesting theories about what's going to happen to mankind in the next couple hundred years as we bond with our robotics and our circuitry and our technology. What about the next generation of all of these robots? And so the character Father came about as Jody and I were working back and forth, figuring out how to make some of this stuff work. And it was so rich and so big that all we could really do is tell a very small chunk of it with the Deathlocks. But the Deathlocks are just one piece of this giant puzzle that Father's involved with, as well as a number of characters we haven't introduced. And they're all these really terrific and very cool sentient, conscious, living, breathing, procreating versions of the, you know, there's the Sentinots, there's the Doomborgs, there's Machine People, there's the Life Model Destructoids, there's the Legion of the Deathlocks, there's all of these, you know, there's the Ultravisions, there's all of these clans now of hyper-evolved sentient descendants of the famous Marvel robots. And that gave birth to a lot of big stories that we'll both be seeing in Secret Avengers and Uncanny X-Force. So, you know, if you like that sort of thing, you should totally read both of those books.
That's awesome. So it's kind of mind-blowing, actually, when you think about it.
It's got a lot of potential, and you know, those are the. It's nice to be in a situation where, when you have an idea like that, you know, I've done plenty of automaton revolution stuff in Fear Agent and robot species, and it's fun. But I think that this is a very unique idea that only really works in a mainstream, you know, comic universe like Marvel, because I can then take these things and kind of. You know, they're recognizable. It's like a living, you know, like Emperor Doomborg is going to be a character who leads the Doomborgs, and you know, each one of these clans of species have leaders, and they're all individuals. And then the biggest of all of them are the Adaptoids, which the Adaptoids are obviously evolved from the Super Adaptoid, and where Sentinels hunt mutants, the Adaptoids hunt Avengers, and they have a very, you know, personal reason to be doing this, and so. Building all of these new species that come out of these famous Marvel characters is something you can only really do in a situation like this, and it really gets it gets exciting. You have a lot of fun world building this stuff.
Very cool, very cool. So you're working with Gabe Hardman on Secret Avengers, and you guys did a Dr. Voodoo story before, right? But that, other than that, that's the only time you've worked together.
Yeah, he came in and helped out on a couple of issues of Dr. Voodoo, and man, it was just such a treat. He's so good, and it's just, you know, he's a world-class storyboard artist, storyteller in general, and so I had seen his work with he and Jeff are frequent collaborators, and I had seen his work in Agents of Atlas, and I always been floored by it, so it was a real treat. So when they said that he might be available for this, I was very excited.
So has he come around on the Captain Britain? Because when we talked at New York Comic Con, he's like, yeah, I don't see it.
I don't know if he has or hasn't. He draws him great. Yeah. We came up with a thing where Captain Britain's costume shifts into a darker version when he's in covert actor mode. Because it's a science suit, you know. For me, like, Captain Britain's armor is just a battery pack on an iPhone, and it collects the magic from Avalon and another world, and stores it for him and power. And it's his integrity and his courage and his heart and his belief in himself that then, you know, draws the magic and uses it. So I like the idea that he's like Iron Man powered by magic in a certain way, kind of, you know, but really it's him that's powering it. I do a better job of explaining it in the actual book, I promise.
No, I was just, my immediate thought is, shit, man, we don't deserve the level of quality that you're bringing to this. Like, it's like, I just, you're talking about what makes up Captain Britain, and I'm just thinking about, like, the past years of, well, Captain Britain MI-13 was good. Paul Cornell did a great job on that. But, like, the last volume of a new Excalibur that we had, where they tried to explain the sword and the not the shield, but the rose or whatever, you know, like the scepter or the sword, you know, like those two different directions Captain Britain can take, and it was just so awful. And like, to hear you talk about actually giving thought to Captain Britain and I want to read this right now. Like, that's so, it's like,
that's a good sign. I haven't really talked a lot about this with too many people, so it's nice to hear that. That is, it's nice to hear a fellow geek respond that way, because I'm not, you never know. So hopefully it works out. I mean, I've got enough belief in it, and the ideas came in such a solid tidal wave and hit me so hard that I pushed for, you know, not only an entire X-Force arc, but to start building him as a major character in the Avengers. And people agreed. So, you know, when guys like Tom Brevoort and Nick Lowe and Jody LaHoop were agreeing with those ideas, I got to assume that there's something behind them, and hopefully, you know, the end result will warrant all the time and energy put into to sort of trying to, you know, dust him off again and give him.
I can't wait. So, but then also on Secret Avengers, like you mentioned, is Venom, and you've been rolling on Venom, and that's been another surprise. And that how good that. I mean, I we joked about it when we first started. I was like, really, Venom? But you know,
sure.
And somehow you survived Spider Island, and that actually made the crossover better. Like, I was skeptical of that too. It was just.
I mean, I've got a chip on my shoulder. I don't think anybody who knows me knows that. You know, like, did I go to Marvel to take Venom? Can I be honest? You know, absolutely fucking not. I didn't. Absolutely did I not give up all my creator-owned books to come do Venom.
Yeah.
And now that said, Stephen Wacker's listening to this going, like, never work for me again.
Well, I can guarantee Steve Wacker's not listening to this.
Okay, all right.
Let's be
honest. Good. Then let's talk about Wacker. I like working with Steve quite a bit, and he and Slott had put together a really terrific setup here with Flash, and it was talking with Wacker as he sold me on this, because, you know, he's a bright guy too, and it's his job to, like, try and make these things good, and Steve's taken that stuff and done some amazing. I mean, look at The Line right now, look at Daredevil and Punisher and Moon Knight and everything he's done with these street books, and so. Dealing with Steve on this thing that they had set up, I got excited about Venom because the setup worked as such a character piece, and it really does. You know, it's a former bully, who turned alcoholic. It's like this very tragic figure, Flash, who has never really been given that much attention or that much focus. But when you mix him with the Venom symbiote that feeds off of these negative emotions, and you know the setup, I don't have to go through it all. But when Wacker sort of presented it to me, I just wanted to give it a shot, and I also see it like a challenge, you know, and that chip on my shoulder is like, all right, well, you know what? It's Venom. I'll be honest, there haven't been a lot of Venom books that I gave two shits about, to be honest, you know, like, look, fuck it. If anybody's listening to this and they're a big Venom fan, they're like, that Rick Remender ring. I'm sorry. When I first heard it, I had a knee jerk reaction, like, meh, no. But then as I heard the setup and found, I really fell in love with it and heard the passion that Slott had for Flash, it really helped me buy into this. And I just made my mind up, like, look, if this is the assignment that I'm being given right now, and I'm really fortunate enough to pay my bills writing stories, then it's my job to dump everything I've got into this. And if Venom is an uphill battle, if Venom is something where everybody has a predetermined sort of sense of what it is and that they're only going to care so much about it, then it's my job to pour so much into it that, because you really have to. You have to exceed expectations on something like Venom, like triple fold in order to make anybody pay any kind of attention to it. I just gave it everything I had, and I don't know. People seem to respond to it. The reviews are great. The book sells very well, and so hopefully it continues to, you know, it continues to be something that people enjoy reading. I know that I haven't put as much personal stuff into writing a character or getting into a story as I have in this.
Some of that stuff. I mean, some of the with his dad and the family relationship stuff. I mean, like it's not a direction I thought Venom would go in, and I like that because it's challenging. Like I'm, you know, as I get to be an older comic book reader, like I'm attracted to artists that don't look like everyone else. I'm attracted to stories that aren't the same story I've read for the past 20 years. And this, yeah, that was, you know, totally did that, you know, with Tom Fowler and Tony Moore just killing it you make Venom into a tragic figure, like, or it's not, it wasn't about Venom, it's about Flash. Like the book
it's
should
about
be called
Flash.
Yeah, exactly.
Same way that Iron Man's about Tony Stark. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's about Flash, and that's what I really fell in love with.
Yeah, you should make Iron Man about Tony Moore.
Yeah, that's almost what I said.
I know, yeah. You should.
You missed the deadline, Iron Man. Tony's been keeping all his deadlines lately.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Tony, so he's where he's coming back, and he's doing the bookend part of the big February every day of Venom comic comes out event.
Every day of Venom comic, yeah. And it's funny because I got a lot of people like, I really love this book, but you guys are doing a lot in February, huh? And man, I hope people buy it because, you know, Marvel did this because they really like the story that we had cooked up, and they really have responded to the stuff here. I think it's so good. I mean, I don't know. I just got done doing the final pass, and issue 13 is 30 pages penciled and inked by Tony Moore with a alternate cover by Walt Simonson for $3.99. Like for $3.99, we're just trying to like. Everyone's like, well, $3.99 for 20 pages, boo-hoo. You know what I think? I think I'll give you 30 pages of one of the best working guys. You know, Tony Moore is, in my opinion, one of the top 15 guys working in comics. We're going to give you 30 pages by him with a Walt Simonson cover, and it's like a story that we've bled. Like, I don't see how you could not love it. It's I love it. I don't know.
Well, but, and I mean that's similar. People bitch and moan about Fantastic Four 600 that it was $7.99, but it was 100 pages of story. There was no reprints. There was no anything like that. I mean, $3.99 for 30 pages of Tony Moore. I'll sign up for that. But that's interesting because, you know, you got people bitching about the prices, and then honestly, you know, like I was on the press conference with you when Marvel announced it. And we were talking about it, and even I went, wow, you know, like six weeks of straight comics going through. I mean, as the creator, you're pouring yourself into the project. Does it chip away at you when you go and you see fans bitching because it's coming out 6 weeks in a row and they're bitching about having to pay for it?
I guess I get it. You know, everybody's the cynicism at this point. Everybody is cynical. The companies have burned people. I don't give a shit. Everybody knows that. I mean, it's not like I'm saying anything that's a secret. Every company has burned the fans on some level on something. Where they've realized that they're now buying something that they're not enjoying, and it was just something that was ancillary and not a lot of love put into it. I've worked myself to death my entire career to make sure anything I'm associated with hits a certain level. In my mind, the level in based on my tastes and what I consider to be quality. I've always thought of, you know, I did two books that will remain nameless early in my career that I rushed out. I realized after doing them, like, well, what the fuck was the point of that? You know, like, what was that? That wasn't your best work. And so let's say, you know, 8,000 people, that was their first experience with you. And they're like, they're not going to come back. They're going to think, you know, I paid cash for this and you gave me like half what you're capable of. So you know, I'd say, you know, for the last 5 years, I don't think that there's anything that I've put out that I can't get behind. I've really worked myself to death. And so in terms of this, I hope that over amount of time, I can build a reputation with the mainstream fans as well, where they'll know that I'm not going to do something like this unless it's good, or I'm just not interested in it.
Right.
And
I know that from knowing you for as long as I've known you and your work and stuff, like knowing that the quality comes from it. But it's like even me writing about it, like I get excited when you have an announcement because I know it's going to be good. And then I get a little crestfallen when my commenters are like, well, fuck that. It's, you know, I'm like, no, but it's going to be good. Rick cares. You know,
I'll have to earn it. You have to earn it one book at a time. I tell you this, the Spider Island stuff was fun. And I used it to really develop the rest of the stuff with Flash's dad. But the story picks back up on issue 10, and it goes like a freight train into you know, an orphanage. It's a fucking mess. What we're doing to this book? I mean, it's awesome mess. But the story is on. I just got done 10, 11, 12, 13 are all, you know, put to bed now, so I can see the first arc coming out of Spider Island, and it's. You have no idea what to expect, and that's the kind of comic books I like. You know, we spend a lot of time developing Jack-O-Lantern, which is a character I've really begun to dig writing. But by the time the crossover comes, it's unlike anything else you'll be able to get on the comic book stands, and it's all dumped and dipped in love by Tony Moore for the first issue. That's 30 pages by Tony. Then Rob Williams comes on for two issues dealing with two characters he knows really well, the new Ghost Rider and X-23. It's they're all together. It's all big. One, like at this point, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that once the initial concept was there, the rest of this was worked up with Jeff Parker and Rob Williams and I. We all worked up the story and worked very hard to make sure that it was something we were all really proud of.
Well, I mean, the direction Venom's been going in, I mean, the fact that you could work in, like I said, all the emotion stuff and then put him on Cap's 1970s motorcycle. And then, and I'm a big Red Hulk fan, so like I'm all about Jeff Parker. I think is doing great work on Thunderbolts and Hulk. It's like, so I mean, I think it's gonna be good. I'm buying all the issues and that like, and that's why I think people realize I don't get this shit for free. Like, if I want to read your stuff, I've got to buy it too. So it's like,
yeah. So. I think that you'll get your money's worth on this. I know that I've read everybody's issues. They're all terrific. It's an explosion of insanity. But we made sure that it was a character piece more than anything else. So it's four characters that everybody go, oh, it's like the Red Hulk. Oh, it's the Girl Wolverine. Oh, it's Venom. Oh, it's the new Ghost Rider. The idea was that, you know, with characters like this, these are the kind of characters that we can bend more, and these are the kind of characters we can tell, you know, character stories with. And so after the high concept was cooked up and we really got into the nuts and bolts of the plot, the number one priority that Jeff and Rob and I wanted to focus on with editor Janine was to spend hours figuring out what's the heart of the character stories here with these four, now that they're all thrown into the situation together. And man, it's everybody did a great job. Jeff Parker did an especially great job with an issue that I think people, you just have no idea what's going to come. It's a big thing, and I think people will enjoy it if they give it a shot. And, you know, bookends with Tony Moore and lots of good stuff in the middle.
Yeah, awesome. Can't wait. So cool. So now, in addition to that, we saw you finally say good night to Fear Agent. I know that's an emotional topic, but how was the reaction? Were you, you know, like, It's over. I'm a little choked up.
yeah, the reaction was nice. You know, people who there's always that part of the industry that just don't give a shit and they'll never cover it and they'll just act like it doesn't exist and, like, you know, whatever, it doesn't sell enough for them to care or whatever. So those people are never gonna care about it, and probably it'll always just not hit a sales, you know, level that'll warrant it to have acknowledgement. but you know, like, the reaction that I did see from fans of it was very positive. And you know, again, the end of the Dark Angel saga and the end of Fear Agent, I was working those both up around the same time. or at least I was. I knew they were going to be coming out around the same time, and I had a lot of anxiety given how much at that point had been built up for both of those things, and that if I didn't stick those landings, that was kind of going to be it. Like, if you build up a 32-issue story in something like Fury Agent and don't stick your landing, there's a lot of people not going to come back. I wouldn't, you know, I'd be like, oh, well, thanks. You know, like Lost, like if they started that show again, even though we all kind of knew bullshit, fakery, writer's room. even though you kind of knew, you're still hoping that the rumors you heard about how the show came together were wrong and that there was still a plot for the end. And yeah, there wasn't. It was like, and then there was a magic ghost dog and he was a friend to everyone and they had chili. And I wouldn't go back and watch that if they relaunched that show. So in anything, you got to stick your landing if you want people to, you know. In Twin Peaks, for example, like, yep, they did. That was a nightmare. Like, the second season fell to shit. And at least for the last 3-4 episodes, Frost and Lynch came back and stuck some kind of an interesting landing with it.
But that was painful, though. It was like, after that's such a strong first season, and then that second season, just to see it just get, it's like they spread the pieces out on the table and walked away. And it was like,
yeah. Only to come back for the last 3 episodes just to kill everyone and shit on everything. But I kind of loved that. I don't know. I look back on that like, you know, it's Lynch and Frost just blowing up their characters and having Bob possess Agent. You know, it's just all these really ugly things, and it was like a big fuck you, but I don't know. So it's nice that people have responded to both of those. And Fear Agent was, you know, it was one of these things where I just wanted to make at least one book that, you know, if it was the only thing that I ever got to make, and I ended up, you know, shuffling off and going back into video games and animation, and I didn't keep doing comics, that there would be that one thing that I could go, hey, here's 7 volumes of this, and I'm pretty sure it's as good as I can do.
Well, it was. I mean, it was that last issue. I mean, the last sequence was just, again, emotional, and, you know, and it was just great. I mean, we raved about it and all that stuff, but yeah, I was excited. But
I appreciate the support. Beyond that, I know that you actually do enjoy it enough that you want to bang the drums, and it helps, you know. Yeah. I mean, if you guys have brought a couple thousand readers to the book and trade, and that makes a big difference in being able to keep it in print.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. So now, you know, with you being at Marvel, there was a lot of the kind of, oh, we're never gonna see creator on stuff again. But the other night on Twitter, you were posting art from the next Last Days of American Crime. Did I see that correctly?
Yeah.
So what's happening?
It's a story that I picked up shortly after wrapping up the first one, and Tokini couldn't come back and do it, and so I didn't want to do it until I found an art team that I don't want to divulge who they are just yet, but I found a way to team 2 guys together who I'm a big fan of both and get something really exciting and unique out of it. And so got in touch with Radical and we put it together. You know, let's do a second one. The first one has sold, you know, it's sold gangbusters. It sold like 20,000 copies in trade, and Greg Tokini, it's blown him up in Europe. He's a superstar now because of it. As well he should be, you know, I mean, but he sold like every single original page in Europe, and there's like, you know, it's translated into like 5 or 6 languages. It really was a pretty big thing, you know, for us. And beyond that, I had the second story. It was just something where I wanted to make sure I had art that was you know, of the same quality as the first one to carry it. And, because God knows my writing can't.
Oh, stop. Well, that's cool. So what kind of sketch? I mean, like, it's probably early on. Like, when do you think that's going to hit the world?
Probably announce it not in too long. I really want, we've got 15 pages done right now. I think that we all kind of want to get to a point where we've got, you know, like 30, 40 pages in the can and a couple covers. And I like to announce things like, you know, like to do the official announcement late in the game where you can show a lot. You want to get people crazy excited, and when all you've got is some sketches and a logo, it's anticlimactic.
Vaporware, so, to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Cool. So, I mean, you're one of the hardest working guys. I mean, I see you post that people follow on Twitter. You're up late, you know, killing yourself to get these books out, and, you know, I personally appreciate it. So thank you for everything you do. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm able to write stories for a living, and people read them and pay for them, so really... I'm the one. I'm the grateful one.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, thanks, Rick. You know, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's always good that you remember us little people at iFanboy to check in with our audience.
I don't look at it. you're not that little, Ron.
Well, let's be honest, right?
We're neither of us so little anymore.
And a big thanks goes out to Rick for giving us some of his time to chat about X-Force. Trust me, people, if you're not an X-Men fan, it doesn't matter. This is great comic book stuff. Everybody that reads it agrees. Go pick up the hardcovers. You won't regret it. But in the meantime, go to ifanboy.com where you can check out all the other podcasts and writing, and there's the comic section where you can do your pull list, and you can email us at contact@ifanboy.com with any questions or concerns, as well as follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/ifanboy and facebook.com/ifanboy. So until next time, have a great holiday season and enjoy your comics.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ifanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ifanboy.